Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by the all-new 2015 Jeep Renegade.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 288 for May 22nd of 2015. Mr. Gas Monkey gets fast and loud. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific or 19 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Gas Slash, we're back at it again.
We're back at it. How you been?
I've been doing great. We got all kinds of things to talk about. We got a great guest coming on the show. We got to talk about that, too. But before we get to that, got to let everybody know that Mike Austin has joined us. Now, the last time you were here, Mike, you were with Pop Mechanics magazine, right?
Yes.
That is so not true anymore. Tell us what you're doing now.
I moved on to Autoblog. I'm the editor-in-chief now, and it's the
Now, wait a minute. You didn't go over there as editor-in-chief.
No, I didn't. I went over as executive editor.
And then they said, hey, this guy's pretty good, huh?
Not quite.
just go with it. Just say yeah.
Yeah. They liked me enough to keep me there instead of kicking me out as soon as there was an
opening.
Kicked
you up.
Well, cool. Great to have you back here.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And then we got to let everybody know our special guest for today's show is Richard Rawlins. The star of Fast and Loud on the Discovery Channel. And Richard, it's so awesome to have you on After Hours with us today.
Right on, guys. Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Hey, before we get going, let me do a little promo here for something that we're doing on the show, because Richard gave us three autographed copies of his new book. And this is what I really want to talk about on the show, as well as his show. But this book is pretty cool. You can win an autographed copy of this. We have all different kinds of ways to enter this contest through Twitter, through YouTube, through Facebook, or just sharing the contest with friends of yours. So pick a way that's working best for you, and just look for autoline.tv, and we've got more there of how you can do it. So anyway, we got that out of the way. Richard, what led you to... I mean, look, you're a very famous guy in the United States right now, and it's going global. You got this TV program that's really kicking ass. What led you to write a book about yourself?
Well, you know, I mean, it was natural progression. Gas Monkey itself has been in works for, you know, 12, 13 years now. And, you know, when we got the show, that increased in popularity. And it was a natural answer, kind of a tell-all book of all the normal questions, you know, where'd you come from? How'd you get to do this? You know, what's your background? It was more of just kind of answering all the questions that I get asked, you know, on a daily basis.
I got to tell you, you know, when I first knew of you, didn't really know you, I thought, well, this is just some crazy ass Texas Yahoo. And then I read your book and I thought, I'm right. He is a crazy ass Texas Yahoo, but you're an entrepreneur, man. I had no idea of the background of how you got to where you are. And I swear to God, people should read this book because it's motivational. It's instructional. I mean, this is almost a how-to book on being an entrepreneur.
Well, I typically call it an entrepreneur because I'm always putting my hands in the shit. But I've led a couple of three different lives, and all of them have kind of pointed me in the right direction to get to here.
So tell us about your background in cars. I mean, I think those of us in the Midwest, when we think about Texas, we think about pickup trucks. But there's a lot more to what you're up to in terms of vehicles.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've been flipping cars on the side just for extra money since I was in high school. And, you know, now that on the show, what's really cool is we don't put ourselves in any certain genre. We're not afraid of a foreign car or a different car that we've never messed with, or trucks, or, you know, giant trucks or little trucks, or, you know, we'll really pretty much mess with anything. It's kind of always been Gas Monkey style. It's kind of what the monkey's all about. You know, he kind of irreverently yet comically has a little fun with everything.
In the whole notion of Gas Monkey, now you've created this brand and you're extending it. Tell us a little bit about the background of that whole idea.
Well, you know, I used to be in advertising and marketing. So when I sold that company, we were sitting around and I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And I knew I wanted to do something with cars and motorcycles, and I needed to come up with a name. And we're just, you know, after a few beers, you know, one good idea turns into a bad one. And then the next thing you know, you get the perfect one. And we came up with Gas Monkey Garage, and it kind of stuck. So we took off from there.
Like I said, what I find so interesting about your book is how many different careers, I guess, you've really had. You were a fireman, you were a policeman, you got into the printing business of all things, and parlayed some of all that into to Gas Monkey. But what I really like about the book is, you know, it really kind of is the American dream. This is somebody pulling himself up by his own bootstraps. And I wonder, was that part of what you really wanted to get across in the book?
It really was important to me. I didn't want to think some TV producer came along and found, a little hot rod shop in Dallas, or that, I had a silver spoon or a trust fund or what have you. I'm very proud and very humbled by what Gas Monkey has become. And so I really wanted to get across that, you know, we live in a fantastic country that allows us to do pretty much anything that we decide that we want to do. And I wanted to, you know, really drive that point home that, you know, if you don't like your job and you hate what's going on, you know, you and you alone have the power to change it.
So could you tell us about some of the cars that you've worked on that you've really liked and admired and maybe didn't want to flip that you really hang on to?
Yeah, well, I've got my green Mustang that you see from time to time on the show that's, kind of one of those things I'll never sell. And then we've got the 52 fleet line that I was fortunate enough to get to buy back. And that was the first car that Gas Monkey ever built. And then I have the Model A that was the first episode of Fast and Loud. That went across the block at Barrett Jackson a couple of years ago. And I was like, well, you know, I've got the first car we ever built, the first car we built on TV, you know, so that's kind of rounds out my collection and as far as my personal cars, and everything else is kind of inventory. You know, my garage is full of all kinds of different stuff. And, you know, if I was a blue jean guy, I guess it'd be full of blue jeans, but I happen to be a car guy, you know, so we really like the diversity of what we put ourselves into here. We're not 69 Camaro builders, you know, and we're not, Ricer, you know, builders. We're everything. Now, like right now, we're building our supercar for this year. It's a 2006 Ford GT that got smashed up pretty much like the F40 Ferrari that we did last year. And, of course, we're putting our spin on it and making it a little bit better and faster and leaner and leaner and what have you. But it's really cool. There's pretty much not anything that we haven't touched on. There was one category that we hadn't touched on in the whole lifetime of Gas Monkey, and we just finished it. And we built our version of a full-arm lowrider, you know, arm hydraulics, et cetera.
In fact, it looks like you got that F40 on the wall behind you in a picture.
Oh, yeah, it is. Yes, definitely.
So talk about that through a bit, because, I mean, you guys are really good at cutting metal and welding and all that, and that thing's pretty much carbon fiber, isn't it?
No, actually, the metal's aluminum on the frame, and we were able to, I mean, Ferrari said the car couldn't be built. They told it. And then they wanted to, you know, ship it over to Italy, and we ended up getting our hands on it, and I don't think they were very happy about it, because they said if it could be built, that it was going to take at least 2 years, and we built that car in 22 days, we are really like that car. We got with Penske, we got with redid the turbos. I forget all the people that put their 2 cents in on that, but we got that car laser straight, back on the ground, and super fast.
That's pretty impressive because, I mean, you know, if anybody who watched the show early on would think that you're just a bunch of hot rodders. But obviously the show has evolved and you guys want to show off the different kind of skills that you're willing to tackle just about anything.
You know, we really are. I mean, and we've got a great group here. I mean, when you watch the show and you see a show that is one episode and you see the car start to finish, that is actually 2 week time span. And then if you see one that is in two episodes, that's a 4 week build. So like the Ferrari was a 4 week build, about 22 days flat. And we're taking these cars all the way down. That's paint. That's everything. And that was one of the things that was the hardest to get the show sold, was the networks didn't believe that you could build a car that fast. They're like, it just can't happen. We've looked at it and everybody says it takes a year to build a custom car, et cetera, and so forth. And I'm like, not with the right equipment and team. It's at the end of the day, it's a motor, transmission, rear end, wheels, tires, paint, and interior. Let's go.
and the hours. I mean, you talk about that in the book, man. It's like you guys never sleep.
Yeah, it's pretty rough. It's a little bit better now. The first couple of years was pretty tough because we were trying to get our rhythm and figure it out. It's slightly better now, but we don't do like 3 months worth of filming and take a few months off. We film straight through the year. Everybody comes to work just like a regular job, and then we take a week vacation in the summer and maybe a week during the holidays, and that's it. It's a regular Monday through Friday job, and a lot of times Saturday and Sunday also.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite stories in the book, when you got the three-window coupe and the shoot was basically done for the day. And you were like, no, we got to go. We got to do this. And you pushed it past that. And I think that was a big surprise for me because, most reality show people don't know behind the scenes, it's a lot more staged. And you guys are clearly, setting your time frame and letting the TV keep up with you, right?
Yeah, and that's really one of the things I'm the most proud of, because I know a little bit about the business now, and I'm really proud of the fact that these are really my risk in our cars, and we really are building them, we really are selling them, and there is no script, and the TV's got to keep up with us, because when I do the books, or I do the plan, Aaron tells me how long it's going to take, and what parts he needs, and I determine if I can afford to put that much money into the car and hopefully get out and make some money. Which doesn't always happen, but so they're really up to following us instead of saying, oh, okay, today we're going to do this and this and then disappear. They're here 12 to sometimes 16 hours a day if they stagger the crews.
Have you ever thought of doing more in racing? I know you guys built a car for Pikes Peak, that Falcon, that was pretty wild. Have you ever thought of doing more in motor racing?
Well, we are. I've got the Top Fuel NHRA team now with Hennin Motorsports. We're racing out at Topeka, Kansas this weekend, actually. Aaron's running and campaigning his Falcon on about four or five different events this year. I would get into more of it myself, but right now I'm a little strapped with, all the things going on in Gas Monkey. So no time this year, but I wouldn't mind getting into it.
You did the Gumball 3000 back in 2003. Tell us about that experience.
The Gumball is a really cool event. It is a lot of fun. You can meet a lot of interesting people. As a matter of fact, a couple of very good friends of mine I've met through Gumball. I've ran a couple of them, but that year we went from San Francisco to Miami, and it's a heck of a run. You run each day, and then you party that night and have a good meal and get up the next day and go at it again. But we were able to win that one that year. My wife was actually my co-pilot, and I showed up with a big Chevy Avalanche 4x4 truck, and people just were – these rich guys were looking at me with their Ferraris and Lamborghinis and everything else, just laughing. I was like, that's all right. It's kind of like turtle with the hair, man.
That's great.
Has the success of the TV show surprised you, or did you expect that it would be as popular as it's proven to be?
I don't say I suspect, but I hoped. It was something that I was aiming for. I really paid attention to those before me, and I really wanted to show that we could not only make a good show that wasn't, just to the gearheads, but was also to the families and the kids and the what have you. So we have grandmas and children and people of all ages that really enjoy the show. And that was what was important to me. It was to make it watchable, because I used to watch a lot of the shows being into cars and motorcycles that I am. And I'd lay there and drink my beer and watch the shows and just be all gung-ho about it. And then I'd turn the TV off and go, damn it, I can't have a $230,000 motorcycle. So we really try to bring it down to the average guy or gal that can have a toy in any demographic and in any income stream. So that's why you'll see us build things that are $10,000, $5,000, all the way up to every once in a while we're gonna build something pretty crazy like the Ferrari or whatever. But we try to run the gamut, because we want everyone to know that this is a hobby that you can participate in at any income level.
Richard, what's, in your mind, the key to the show's success? I mean, besides your personality and the things you're doing, as you just mentioned, grandmas and grandpas and little kids and moms and others who you might not think would watch a show like that love it. In your mind, what's the key to that happening?
I think that the actual element of this is a real working shop really comes through in the show, and then the family element of you know, the guys that work here and, you know, how long Aaron and I have been together and how completely different we are. I mean, everybody would think that we're just like the best buddies in the world. We hang out every, I mean, we worked together for 13 years and, you know, other than when we're traveling, I don't think we've had an actual, you know, gone out to have a steak. We're just two completely different individuals, but we both love what we do. And I think that the audience sees that element and the fact that I can't do what he does. He can't do what I do. And it makes it a perfect setup that we don't get in each other's way. So, you know, you throw in that with a little bit of the, smartassness that both of us can deal out, and it makes a good little show.
When you're talking to people, are you finding that there continues to be a real interest in hot rods and modified cars, that people aren't losing interest in those things and, you know, thinking more along the lines of sports cars and exotics and things like that?
No, I think there really is. I mean, it goes back to no matter where you're at in the world, for that matter, cars are ingrained into us. I don't think we're ever going to lose it completely, but I definitely think that it could be on a downturn. The kids are on computers and the cell phones and the what have you. And, you know, they don't care. They just want to – it's just transportation to them. With that said – you know, shows like Ask Monkey, I think, are helping bring back a little bit of interest in, holy cow, you know, I guess I can make my Scion go faster. And the difference is you know, the new kid coming up with all the new toys and the cars is, you know, his toolbox is a computer and instead of hard wrenches.
You know, speaking of that, hard wrenches, that's one of the things I really like about the aspect of the show. One of the biggest problems that the automotive industry faces right now is hiring people, you know, whether it's in engineering or manufacturing. It's hard to get people into that discipline. I'm telling you, there's thousands of jobs going begging in the automotive industry right now on all kinds of levels, at the automakers, at the suppliers, at the dealerships and all. And that's what I love about your show, is you're showing there's no shame in getting your hands dirty. It's really cool to make stuff. There's a great sense of satisfaction in making it. And I'm hoping that you're going to bring a new generation into this industry.
Well, I don't know if I can single-handedly do it, but me and Aaron are definitely interested in making sure that they understand, you know, get out there, have some fun. I mean, I can't tell you how many dads get, you know, their eyebrows kind of lift up, because I'll tell the little kids, you know, I'm like, hey, has your dad got a lawnmower? I'm like, yeah. And I'm like, he's got some tools? Yeah. And I'm like, well, go take it apart. If he gets mad at you, I'll buy him a new one. You know?
That's great.
That's really good. So you're expanding beyond Gas Monkey Garage. You're expanding beyond your television show. Tell us what you're doing, and what's the master plan, or is there one behind all this?
You know, it really is the growth of everything. A bar and restaurant was kind of a natural progression, but we didn't. Gas Monkey tries not to do anything small. When we bust open the doors, we want to walk in tall. So we opened Gas Monkey Bar and Grill about a year and a half ago, and it holds a little over 2,000 people. Has two stages, one indoor and out, and we've got a really good little bar and grill there going, and it's doing excellent. That prompted us to open a couple more. We've got one at DFW Airport at the International Terminal. We've got a new one called Gas Monkey Live that we just opened that holds about 3,000 people. And it's more of a live music venue right across the street from the current one. So we're able to bring in some top quality acts to Dallas. I've had Motley Crue there, Dwight Yoakam. Tomorrow I've got, or Saturday, I've got Queensryche. I mean, we're bringing in some pretty cool stuff and having a good time. We're going to expand into Vegas and Foxwoods. We'll get Foxwoods Casino also.
So are these all bands that you particularly like? I mean, is it sort of your type of music?
Oh, no, it's a little bit of my type of music, but we play a little everything there. I mean, Peter, that books all of our music, does a fantastic job. And we've got aspirations of having, you know, 20 to 40 of these in the very, very near future. The beauty part of, I guess you asked about the master plan, is I won't do anything that I'm not involved in. I don't want to loan my name or Gas Monkey name to something and just hope for some mailbox money. So when we do something, and when you see Gas Monkey do something, that's investment, that's time, that's really is, you know, me and Gas Monkey, or me and Gas Monkey and Aaron doing it, you know, completely and making it happen. I saw too many failures out there in the world where someone would reach a spot of being popular and loan their name out, and it didn't work because they didn't have any hardcore investment in it.
Hey, we've got to take a real quick break here. We got to pay some bills. We're going to take a quick break with our good friends at Bridgestone with their message, and we're going to be back with Richard Rawlins in just a minute. And thank you for that, Bridgestone. Hey, Richard, getting back to the different things you're branching out on, you even have your own branded vodka.
Well, no, it's actually tequila.
Tequila, excuse
me. Yeah. We like our tequila down here in Texas, but we just launched that. Just launched it about 2.5 weeks ago. I think we're in 7 states right now. It's Gas Monkey Cinnamon Tequila. It's a good drinkable drink. It's at a good price point. It's not any of this fancy, $18 worth of packaging, in boxes. It's just to grab a bottle off the shelf and, if you're having a good time, add a little and have a real good time.
So with all this going on, the restaurants, the tequila, and the shop, do you ever think you're going to get tired of any one thing? Like say, hey man, I've done as many cars as I want to do, or I'm just getting tired of it.
That's the beauty of it. Aaron will never get tired of building cars, and I'll never get tired of the business aspects of it. So I really like growing the brand Gas Monkey. We've got the apparel and all of the big chain stores and things like that, and then now we've got a Gas Monkey Foundation also that we're giving back. And building is the fun part for me. I mean, I come to work, it's not about making money. It's about the building of everything and just seeing the success and sometimes failures. I mean, I failed twice trying to get here and broke.
Talk about your foundation. I find that fascinating. And talk about, I think there's 4 different causes that you've identified to that you want to get into.
Mostly our Alzheimer's and dementia causes. My dad has dementia and Alzheimer's, and sometimes he knows what's going on and sometimes he doesn't. And, I call it taking care of the old kids, and a lot of them get forgotten. And by the time you're old, your kids are old and they got kids of their own that they're trying to take care of. And it makes it real hard on a lot of families. So I'm really wanting to pay attention to that and try to find a cure or slow it down or at least make it comfortable in the final years of it, because, that disease is really, really bad in the way that you can be deteriorated for a very, very long time because your body's healthy. Your mind is just gone.
Wow.
So on a more upbeat sort of subject, tell us about the Dodge commercials that you were a part of.
That's been a lot of fun. I got to work with Peter Farrelly, the director, and the same CGI company that did Mark Wahlberg's movie Ted. So the little monkey Dodge Law commercials are absolutely hilarious. We had a great time doing them, and we've got some more coming. I was just on the phone a few minutes ago with President of Dodge, Tim Kaniskis, and we've got a few things cooking that'll be coming up that are a little bit more fun. I mean, I'm really proud to be a part of Dodge family because they'll get out there, they'll have a little fun, they'll take some chances, they'll roll with the punches, and they're just faster, quicker at the draw.
Hey, we've got a couple of audience questions here. Armand wants to know, what's it like to be a celebrity and how has it changed your life?
It's pretty awesome, and now I get to supersize my meals. It's a lot of work. One of the things that I studied when I wanted to do this was really watching what others that came before me and how they interacted with the public. So we're very active here about my fences are open. There's a cooler full of beer. We try to shake as many hands as I can and take as many pictures. I want the public to know that we're accessible. I mean, just because we're on TV doesn't mean we're still not just Richard and Aaron making cars and having some fun.
Cool. And AAH Guest 940 wants to know, how do you get around the issue of parts not always being readily available?
Well, when you're working with Aaron, you got to realize 2 things. 1, if the part isn't readily available, he'll make it. And 2, if it's readily available and he doesn't like it, he'll make it. So I can't tell you how many kits he's opened up that, let's say it's a standard lift kit or a brake kit or whatever. And he's like, I can do this better. Let me do this over here.
That's great. Hey, I know you've got a plane to catch, and we want to cut you a little bit loose here, but it's really cool getting on here. I really recommend the book. It's inspiring, it'll make you want to go out and start your own business. In fact, Richard, I think the Harvard Business School ought to do a business case study on you, because seriously, for a guy with your background to get to where you have, it's really outstanding.
Well, that's awesome, and I'm very humbled and blessed to be here for sure. And tell Harvard to call me. I'll tell them what I know.
Hey, thanks, man. Really cool having you on here.
Right on, guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
Cool.
Thanks.
And we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back and be talking about some of the cars that we've been driven and other news that's taken place in the industry.
You already know that you can listen to AutoLine's Industry Insight in places like YouTube and Stitcher, but did you know that you can also listen to it live in your car? It's simple. Just pair your smartphone with your vehicle's Bluetooth connection or plug into the aux jack. Then navigate to AutoLine.tv using your phone's browser. Find the show you want to hear and click play, just like you would on your computer.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy.
It's that easy. Never be disconnected from AutoLine's top-notch insider information with AutoLine on the go.
That's always so weird. Throw into a promo with me in it to come back.
Come back to
weird.
You.
I know. It's weird. We got to get somebody else to do that. You want to volunteer? No, then we come back to you, Gary.
No.
So what have you guys been doing in the last week? Did anyone? No, none of us went and drove the new Camaro, right?
No.
I
no.
We sent Sean from our shop to go drive it, but what's your take on the car anyway, even if you haven't driven it, Mike?
I want to drive it. That's the biggest thing. It doesn't look that different. I mean, it's clearly a new car, but evolutionary, and underneath are the biggest changes.
Yeah, well, it's revolutionary compared to the old car, right? Underneath the skin.
If we go back in time, basically the Camaro's existence is predicated on the existence of the Mustang, right? I mean,
sure, Mustang came first.
Right, so Mustang, and then General Motors says, geez, we have to have something that's going to compete with that. So they developed the Camaro.
And then the Camaro went away, and then the new Mustang came out, and GM said, we need a Camaro again.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if we look at the 2015 Mustang, and now we're going to have the 2016 Camaro, I mean, what do you guys think in terms of, you know, you mentioned it doesn't look that much different, the revolutions under the skin, but... You know, someone might say, well, same thing with the Mustang, you know, with the rear suspension. I mean, big change for that car, right? So is it enough? Will it be enough to be competitive
with
the Mustang?
Ooh. Well, it had been outselling the Mustang.
Right.
Until the Mustang got redesigned. Now, Mustang's outselling Camaro, so your question is, will the new Camaro outsell Mustang?
Right, because, I mean, is it one of these things whereby someone looks at it and says, well, that's sort of like the old one, but, boy, that Mustang really looks sharp? I don't know.
Yeah, it's a good question.
I think it's enough of a modernization. You know, the Mustang might have been more of a styling change from one step to the next, but the Camaro, it looks new. People see it and go, okay, you know it's the new one.
Here's
I don't know if that'll make the sales.
Here's the thing. I think where Mustang's going to have an advantage over the Camaro, not so much in the American market, but as you guys know, Ford's even building a right-hand steer version of this. They're going to sell it in just about every market in the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to give them a volume advantage over Camaro, which means that they can invest more back into it, refresh it more, and certainly make more money off the platform than I think Camaro's going to make, unless GM decides to take the Camaro global.
Yeah, but the Camaro is already based on the ATS and the CTS platform. There's some efficiencies of scale there that they get.
Now all they have to do is sell ATS and CTS.
Yeah.
Well, they've got the capacity in Lansing, Grand River, where the Camaro will be built, and so you know they've got that. I was surprised to see that. So I started looking at the numbers for the new Camaro compared to the Mustang, and was surprised that. They're both 188.3 inches long. I mean, the exact same length.
Exactly the same length.
Yeah, and the wheelbase in the Camaro is bigger, which surprises me. It's 110.7 inches versus 107.1 inches. So, I mean, there's a difference there in the wheelbase.
So the Camaro should ride better, but the Mustang should handle better, just based on that length alone, doesn't mean that it will.
And it sort of occurs to me that if you think about those two cars just visually, that doesn't the Mustang seem... lower and longer.
Wider, for sure.
Than the Camaro. You know, assuming you've got that. So I would have thought that the wheels would be further out.
I mean, in pure side profile, though, they're getting closer. They look more alike than ever.
Mm-hmm. And the width, the Camaro is 74.7 inches wide versus 75.4 inches wide
for
the
Mustang.
Mustang's
wider.
Mustang's wider.
And to my eye, looks wider.
And this is another thing that surprises me. The Mustang is higher than the Camaro.
Wow.
The Camaro,
overall height is higher.
53.1 for the Camaro versus 54.4 for the Mustang. That's a big surprise, I thought.
Yeah, it is.
And then the powertrain thing, we were talking off the camera about that. And they seem to be lining up pretty closely between the engine offerings.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure GM made the decision way before the Mustang was announced, but it looks like, you know, they let Mustang test the water with a four-cylinder turbo,
mm-hmm.
and now they have theirs. But
right.
The Mustang one's a success, so I think the Camaro's 275 horsepower from a 2-liter, that should get the same response, I'd expect.
Well, they have the Mustang has got a 2.3 EcoBoost, which is 310 horsepower, so
right.
It has the horsepower advantage. So
who's got the weight advantage?
Well, So General Motors doesn't have the specific numbers yet in terms of with the weight, but they're talking about how it would be 200 pounds lighter for the new Camaro.
Right.
So I went back. So the lightest current Camaro is 3,702 pounds.
Oh, that's heavy.
Okay, that's and the lightest current Mustang. So this would be
the new one.
The new one,
which got heavier because of the independent rear suspension.
Is 3,524 pounds, okay? So if we take the lightest current Camaro and take out the 200 pounds, then that comes in at 3,502 pounds, which is a difference of 22 pounds. So it's 22 pounds lighter than the lightest current Mustang.
So then the Mustang with the Turbo 4 will definitely have a power-to-weight ratio advantage.
Right. Now, the heaviest currently available Camaro is 3,946 pounds, and the heaviest current Mustang is 3,729 pounds. So if we take the 200 pounds away from the Camaro, that takes it to 3,746, which is heavier than the heaviest Mustang.
But they're almost right on top of each other now.
Yes, almost exactly right on top of each other. And I think part of that weight is because the Camaro is going to have a 6.2-liter V8, and the Mustang has a 5-liter V8. So that's where I'm guessing.
Could be.
That's where I'm guessing the mass
doesn't
is.
The SS version, too, isn't that the 6.2-liter V8 is
that's,
an SS?
That's an SS.
Is that coming with MagnaRide?
I don't know.
I think so. Because I know Ford's putting MagnaRide in the GT350. First time Ford's ever used the technology on any of their cars.
Mm-hmm. But it's just sort of interesting that we're in a situation now, you know, here we are in the 20th century basically dealing with hot rods from the 60s. And we just saw Richard talking about, you know, the interest in his show. And so people still are digging the muscle.
No doubt about it. So, Gary, didn't you just come back from driving the Sonata, Hyundai Sonata?
Hyundai Sonata.
Hybrid.
And plug-in,
right?
Yeah. And
what'd you think?
You know, the driving impressions are off the table until
the embargo comes off
next
right.
Monday night at midnight or something crazy like that. But I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, what they're doing. I mean, it's just basically they're saying, look, you know, in order for us to be compliant going forward and in terms of meeting the regulations and CAFE requirements, we have to have this technology. So we're going to continue to push it. And the thing that I was very curious about is, you know, as we know that Hyundai is based in Korea and a lot of the development that they do is done there. And in fact, these cars will be built in the plant in Korea. The normal Sonatas are built in Montgomery, Alabama. So, I mean, they build them here. But I asked one of the execs, I said, are hybrids well-received in Korea? And he said, no. He said, it's basically they're more interested in diesels. And that surprised me a lot.
Me too.
That this is not.
I didn't realize diesels are popular in South Korea.
And this is the technology that they're doing. But, you know, and the other interesting thing was that when they were giving comparative benchmarks, that it surprised me when you just see it right in front of you how few mid-sized hybrid vehicles there really are. I mean, so their number one comparison, of course, was the Camry, which I would argue that most people don't even realize that there's a hybrid Camry.
Right.
I mean, it's just
it's invisible.
Just, yeah, I mean, and then the Fusion,
right?
Hybrid,
Accord,
the Accord hybrid, and
Malibu's coming,
but that wasn't one comparison. Is there one?
Doesn't Volkswagen?
There's a Jetta hybrid. It's a little smaller.
Yeah, that is smaller. Right.
So are they pushing the tech, though? I mean, they're saying, okay, we're doing this for compliance, but are they still saying,
no, they're saying
it's getting better?
No, it's you know, that whole thing about, you know, is this going to be, you know, especially the plug-in, because basically what they're going to do is with the plug-in is going to go to the carb states. You know, that's going to be the area where they're going to emphasize that. But it has, and I think this is not a driving impression. This is a factual thing. But I mean, it's
just so Gary doesn't get in trouble. This is the fact.
It's like 24 miles electric range, I think it is. Uh-huh. And you know, and one of their arguments is that, you know, this is really nice to be able to go that far, you know, purely on electric, and you know that there are a number of people who could probably go to work and, you know, have a good ride there. But, you know, they're talking about the availability of charging stations are going to be in the carb states versus here. You know what I mean? It's so they're saying it's, yes, it is for compliance. Yes, it is for getting credits. But at the same time, we think that the proposition is sufficiently compelling whereby, you know, well, maybe not you, but someone might be interested in just buying one of these cars. And, you know, and again, and it was one of those situations where, you know, that Hyundai, I think, tends to be, you know, overachievers. They see what the other guys do, and then they say, we're gonna up that. And
but their original hybrid really wasn't very good from a fuel economy standpoint.
Right.
I remember being on the Nakode Drive, North American Car and Truck of the Year thing, and I beat the hybrid with a standard, a base automatic transmission, not manual transmission, by a couple of miles per gallon, driving over a 20-mile route. And it was like, you know, this. So they've got some catching up to do.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, I mean, they're very sensitive to that whole point, I think, because I drove the plug-in for a set range, and I didn't get very great MPGs in my mind. And I had a guy call me yesterday afternoon explaining what the setup had been and why it was in error. So, I mean, they were very concerned that I was going to come away thinking that it was not as efficient as it can be.
But, I mean, they're fast learners, too. That original hybrid drove awful. And then a couple years later, I think purely through software updates, they improved it.
Mm-hmm.
By then, I think people maybe forgot it a little bit. So this one, are we going to see that same kind of improvement over the years?
Well, no, I think, I mean, it's a definite improvement. You know, and you know, talk about, you know, the first one was a little rough, and you know, the changeover was not particularly smooth when you're going in and out of hybrid mode. And what's interesting, one of the things that they did was that they're using their 6-speed automatic transmission.
That's okay. Not a CVT.
Not a CVT, and all of their competitors have CVTs, and so what they're doing is that, you know, they're putting the motor and generator, and they're attaching it to their transmission. So, you know, even though you don't, you know, have the same torque converter set up, it is still much smoother than you might otherwise think, you know, especially, you know, when you're the start-stop situation. Although I've pretty much found that all hybrids seem to be great on start-stop.
Yeah, no, and they are. Well, they got plenty of juice to get that engine going again. You're
relying
on a 12-volt battery.
Yeah, I mean, that continues to surprise me in certain cars, the start stop, that it's like, wow, this thing really is starting up. It's I don't know if you've experienced.
Yeah, I was going to say that's you know, now that we're getting start stop in conventional gas cars, it's surprising how some of them aren't that well worked out. It's like they don't understand the American use case of, I'm at this light, I got to go now.
Right.
They're all getting better, though. And, you know, at first everyone thought, oh, you just turn the engine off and you turn it on. And it's like, no. You've got to have, if it's an automatic, you better have the torque converter primed. You got to have all this other stuff ready to go, fuel in the injectors. Everything's got to be able to go instantly and smoothly.
Right.
So they're all getting better.
Yeah, that smoothly part, they're still, they still have a distance to go, I think. I mean, and it doesn't seem to really matter, you know, how much the car costs. I mean, really expensive ones or right. even economical ones, there seems to be very little difference there in terms of, you know, you can get really good inexpensive ones and really not so good expensive ones.
Yeah, I've been driving a Ford Focus this week and a Honda Pilot. And, I mean, at first with the Pilot, I had to look and go, oh, this has got start-stop. I mean, it was that smooth. You know, you just felt this little bit of it getting going. And so, like I said, they're getting better. Everyone is. Hey, look, we got to take another very quick break right now. We're going to give a shout-out to our friends at Jeep.
Long live the pioneer. Rebels and mutineers. Go forth and have no fear. Come close and lend an ear. And I say, hey.
Thank you, Jeep. We love having you support this program. Oh, during the break there, too, our producer, Chip, just told me we're going to have somebody from the Camaro program here next month, and then in July we're going to have somebody in here with the new Sonata Hybrid. So we'll get into a whole lot more details with those cars on this show coming up. So, Dr. Data, I understand you got some interesting numbers for us to look at.
Well,
this week.
Oh, okay. So, I was standing in Starbucks this morning, and I was rather astonished to look at some of the prices of things. And so, I hadn't realized this, but apparently, Memorial Day is this weekend, and apparently now is a time when lots of people go out and get new cars. And so, there was some information that came from SwapAlease.com. Which has a subset, which is wantalease.com. Okay, so I was looking at what they were saying are these phenomenal deals on cars, and I did a calculation. So if, say, Mike was going to Starbucks every morning and he was getting his venti Oprah cinnamon chai, which costs 5 1/4, and he thought that he'd have a blueberry scone along with it, that given the 6% sales tax in Michigan, that it would cost him $8.16. So if he went there every day for 30 days, that would cost him $244.80.
Yeah.
Okay. So
I think I know where you're going.
This is a good thing. I whenever I'm in Starbucks, I actually order the short, which is like the off-menu smaller coffee.
Yeah.
So it's nowhere near.
So it's not near the Oprah cinnamon chai. Yeah. I mean, it's not even there. And but then I do remember one time you and I were on a car trip somewhere, and we went to L.A. and we were flying somewhere else, and that you had left the airport to go to an In-N-Out Burger.
Yeah. And so you can put it on those terms for sure.
So the In-N-Out Burger. So if you were to buy the In-N-Out Burger double-double burger combo, which gives you the double-double burger, fries, and a medium soft drink.
That's animal style.
$6.70. And if you did that every day, I mean, so.
Right.
So that would be $201 a month. I didn't add the tax because I don't know what the tax is in California. But but I know that you're a big fan of In-N-Out Burger, so I just thought I'd throw that
Thanks.
In there. And so the Swap-A-Lease people came out with these new rates. This is as of this week. They found a Chevy Malibu LT, a Nissan Sentra SV, a Chrysler 200 Limited, or a Volkswagen Jetta S can be leased for $149 a month, okay? So remember, if you're 30 days of the Oprah cinnamon chai and blueberry scone, $244.80, okay? Now, there are...
You can almost afford the insurance then.
And then if you want something a little bit bigger, the Chevy Traverse LT two-wheel drive is $189 a month. The Chevy Equinox two-wheel drive LT, $199 a month, and you couldn't do this on In-N-Out Burger money, but you could do this on Oprah money. an Acura ILX for $229 a month.
Jeez.
Lease.
Now, are these new leases or people looking to get out of their lease?
It appears to be new leases.
Okay.
And so, I mean, I was just, I mean, okay, so doesn't it, okay, let's take the money and put it aside for a minute. I mean, how crazy these deals are. But, I mean, it's just like, okay, you know, we all know the Malibu is going to be redesigned, redone, and, right. and therefore you'd say, yeah, you can sort of see that you'd...
Yeah, blow it out the door.
You'd have right. a... Because so far, the sales are down 12.1% this year. But the Sentra sales are up 24%, 0.1%. The Chrysler 200 sales are up 96%. The Jetta, as all things Volkswagen, is down 6%. but the Chevy Traverse. Now these are not for these models that I specified, just because they don't break it out in terms of the numbers. But Traverse sales are up 35%. Equinox sales are up 23%, and unfortunately for the ILX, they're down 11.5%. So I mean, what do you guys make of this? I mean, A, what do you make of the cheap lease deals?
Well,
and B, what do you make of these cars?
Even at $149 a month, which is mind blowing to me. That's for anybody just walking in off the street. If you are a previous lessee, or if you are an employee of the company, you can get them even cheaper. I've seen them down like around $120. So, I mean, it's... And look, you know, with the Chrysler 200, I don't think there's any question that these incredibly cheap lease deals are what are leading to the sales. And what blows my mind, you mentioned 96%. The 200 is now selling better than the old 200 plus the Dodge Avenger put together. And I didn't think they were going to be able to do this. But clearly, with some cheap leases, I mean, those numbers are extraordinary.
So, what do you think about the cars that I mean, are included with these cheap prices?
I mean, they're good picks. They're brand new cars. Like you said, the Malibu is kind of this sell down thing, but you know, with the Chrysler, I haven't been paying attention to used Chrysler 200 prices. But you know, it's the lease gamble, right? You're like a 199 lease is essentially like $7,200 over 3 years, and is the price of your car going to drop more than that? If so, it's a good deal to lease it versus buying new and selling at the end of that. And I just, $120, $150, you can't find a loan at that rate. So, I guess it's for people who want to get into new cars. That's fantastic.
It is. You know, I've looked at swap-a-lease too, because, presumably here's people that want to swap out of their lease. They want to get rid of it. And what you're talking about here is the new leases. When I've looked, and I haven't looked in a while, but the last time I looked, the lease prices of people wanting to get out of their leases were crazy high, stupid high. And I don't know if you're supposed to go in and negotiate and say, hey, come on back down to reality. But I was specifically looking at C-Max Energies, the plug-in C-Max. They were like $400, north of $400 a month.
Wow.
And I was like, nah, forget it. No wonder you want to get out of the lease. Because this is crazy high.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at a few other models. The C-Max is the one that I really remembered. That was just like, this is stupid. They're never going to get anybody to take it, because you can lease a brand new one for less than these people trying to get out of their leases are trying to swap out of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that was the Starbucks experience of the day.
Very good.
Bring us to
Dr. Data. Mike, I know you had a topic you wanted to bring up on the show, that GM is telling people they own the software in your car.
Right. Well, NHTSA had a hearing this week about general digital copyright stuff. And GM is saying that, especially when it comes to infotainment and telematics and OnStar, the owner of the car is leasing the software.
Like Microsoft, you lease Word or Excel or whatever, right?
Right, but the trick is, and if you want to tune a car now, you want to work on it, you have to, you don't have to, but it's really likely you're going to toy with the ECU or even just somehow interfere with those signals, because you're going to change it off the factory settings. And that's the big question, is are you violating the software agreement to tune your car? That's why, Richard Rawlings, is he going to have a point? He was saying, kids today do stuff on the computer. Is there going to be a point when you can't change a car because you're worried the lawyer's going to come after you?
But would it be that, or would it just simply be a situation where if something went bad with that car that had been hacked, that they'd say, not our problem because you monkeyed with the ECU.
Yeah, I think that would be it, but they haven't addressed it in that manner. Like, you know, like the old way, it's like, well, if you mess with the intake on your car and something happens, that we can make the claim that voids your engine warranty. They don't seem to be approaching it that way, that, okay, this is a warranty violation and we don't care what you do after that. It seems to be, it hasn't been fought in the courts. No one's taken a case against an owner, or the owner hasn't taken it to the manufacturer. And John Deere's another one where they say, right, we own the software inside the tractor. But it seems to be they're going beyond that simple, you know, this voids the warranty and it's your own fault.
I think, you know, it all depends, you know, how it's being used, right? In the sense that, you know, if I'm dating myself, if I bought a CD with music on it and I wanted to copy it, you know, to put on a thumb drive or something like that, I can do that. I mean, who's going to track down and find it? In fact, I can even make copies for my friends. Now, that is illegal, but who's going to track that down? But if I put up on my website, hey, I got all this music, and you can come and get it, and I want to make money off doing this, whether through selling, website advertising, or even charging you some small amount, now I'm in trouble. And I think the same would be with, you know, hot-rodding a car. If I want to get in there and reflash the ECU, and I've got my own mods, it's like, whatever. But if I want to do that and start selling it, then I think I'm going to get a knock on the door from the GM lawyers.
Yeah, I think that's true. They're probably not going to bother just someone in their garage. And I actually, years ago, a lawyer for a different car company told me that their take on it was, if you want to put code on top of the ECU, your own code, or if you want to write a whole new engine code program, that's your prerogative.
Go ahead and do it, right.
That's your prerogative. If you take their code and alter it, and especially if you sell it, that's when you'd be violating that because you're using their existing code that they put money into and they have copyright.
Right,
on.
So it's basically the whole digital rights management situation. And I think that what it says most of all is the extent to which cars are no longer simply these mechanical objects, but cars now are becoming increasingly, you know, data rich, and therefore the people who are doing that development want to protect it just as Microsoft does. I mean, it's just, I mean, I don't, I mean, you know, this point of, I mean, I remember buying, you know, shrink-wrapped Windows, you know, buying it, right, and loading it onto my computer with a CD and having a screen come up which basically tells me that I don't own that. I mean, wait a minute, I just spent, you know, a couple $100 to buy this stuff, but I don't own it? This is insane.
Well, but also, to your point, you know, no one really reads the agreement, right?
Sure.
So, yeah, right.
So everyone's just going to do whatever they want. I hope they're not going to get, you know, cease and desist letters.
Well, where do you draw the line? Because let's say, you know, somebody takes a camshaft and they regrind the lobes. Aren't they violating the intellectual property that GM decided in setting where those lobes should be in the first place? And what if you take a camshaft, modify it, and sell it? I mean, isn't that the same as taking software and modifying it?
Yeah, so that's where, you know, it's incumbent upon GM and every other automaker to maybe express that good faith. Because you're right. That's the same argument.
I wonder if they're really going after the tuner market, where people are selling, you know, chips and stuff like that to hot rod your car. And I mean, why would GM come out and say, hey, we own all
but,
that
but
software?
But as you said, this is, I mean, so John Deere and Caterpillar are two other industrial companies that are really big on this stuff. And I think what they're concerned with is as they sell their product in other foreign markets, that they don't want that stuff ripped off. They're going to be able to, in the international courts, be able to protect their copyright.
Yeah, and they're not making the statement in the context of, hey, stop messing with our cars. They're making the statement in the context of our interpretation of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act is, this is where, you know, this is where we come down on it.
Or is this all looking ahead to the connected car, where everyone's afraid that Google and Apple and Microsoft are going to come in and dominate this market?
Right.
And who owns the data in the car? And who can modify or use that data to do something else? So it almost sounds to me more like, rather than the shade tree mechanic trying to refresh the ECU, this is, you know, a shot across the bow of Google and Apple.
Well, and if you look at smartphones, too, you have, you know, like the Samsung-Apple lawsuit with all these settlements, and every company owns 1,000 different patents, and each one is licensing another one from the other one. it could be this preemptive thing of like, we're covering everything. So if Apple comes in here or Google comes in there and they try to do something with car software, you know, we can stake our own claim on something we did before that.
Well, but a lot of this is coming out of that negotiation for the Trans-Pacific Pact trade agreement, and that has caused this to really be amped up, this whole discussion of digital copyright for industrial things versus digital copyright for, you know, your CD collection or what have you.
Very interesting. Yeah, I hadn't heard a whole lot about this. I'd heard, you know, some people talking about it, but I haven't read up on it or anything like that.
Yeah, it's sort of this low-level thing, but I think it's, you get gearheads really scared about it and reactionary. But it like I said, we don't know where it's going. It could be, you know, they could say, yeah, don't do anything to the car, and it could vary from manufacturer to manufacturer. And also for the aftermarket, you know, I think they see it. There are two things going on. Automakers are saying, we want to have more control over the experience. We don't want people modifying the car in some cases in a way that's going to make the car worse or less reliable, because people won't remember that it was the tuning thing that did that. They'll associate it with the car. And then the other piece is, they see it as a revenue stream. If they can sell performance parts, and you know, you can keep the other guy from the small mom and pop shop from doing it, they'll take all the money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no doubt about it. So what else? Anything else that we missed going on this week? Or?
Well, there's a big Takata.
Oh, the Takata thing. Recall. I'm so sick of the Takata recall.
All right. Indianapolis 500 is this weekend.
Oh, man, I'm going. I'm driving.
This is like, this could be the crashiest Indy 500 in a while. We had, what, four crashes in practice?
Yeah, one very serious one with James Hinchcliffe,
mm-hmm. right.
Which was weird because, you know, I saw the TV coverage of, in fact, I got to back up and say, if not for these accidents, I swear to God, there wouldn't be anything about Indy in the media. this year, you know, they didn't have the qualifying on television. There were a few markets that did, and it was like on ESPN3, which I've never even seen before. So and none of the sports shows, even after the qualifying, said, oh, you know, Scott Dixon's on the pole. No, there was nothing. The only media coverage there's been of Indy up to now has been these four accidents. And then there was the James Hinchcliffe one, and I saw him go into the wall, and I went, wow, that's a hell of an impact. He was very seriously injured. Yeah. He damn near died right there on the track. And they're crediting the safety crew with really being right on the scene, you know, with the right things and knowing exactly what to do that saved his life. And I hope you're wrong, but you could be right, Mike. This could be the crashiest one yet.
Well, yeah, I mean, the car has shown itself to be pretty safe, too. I mean, one of those crashes was a rollover, and, you know, there's no head or neck injury. I forgot who that was. But.
Well, I think... Didn't all three of them sort of go upside down? It was Ed Carpenter, Joseph Newgarden, and Elio Castroneves.
I was thinking of the Castroneves one.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you talk about the lack of coverage. I was surprised that there are two women who are in the field this year, and I had no idea until I was looking
Catherine
at the list.
Catherine Legg one of them, and I think
no,
she...
No, it's Pippa Mann, 31-year-old Brit, and Simona Di Silvestro,
yeah.
A Swiss.
Yeah. And, well, Simona's been running not every single race, but she's been in the series for a couple of years.
But I mean, if this was NASCAR, or if it were
Formula One,
or what's her name,
Danica Patrick. Oh yeah,
when she, you know, I mean, it's like woo,
right?
But nobody cares about this Indianapolis race.
I don't get it because it's got all the makings of a really good race. You know, with these aero kits from Chevy and Honda, it could be phenomenal.
Well, and I mean, the racing is that's maybe the sad truth of IndyCar right now, right? They have all these great street circuits. The racing is better. The competition is better. You have guys like Juan Pablo Montoya coming back in to bring some excitement. And you know, outside of the actual events, which I think are selling well, people don't notice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, part of it is their TV package isn't the greatest. Their season is really short. I want to. The season ends when? The end of August or something like that. It's crazy, and to your point, I'm a Formula One fan, but the racing in Indy's better. You know, deep down through the field. You know, when an Indy race starts, there's at least a dozen drivers and cars that could win the thing. You know, in Formula One, there's maybe two this year, and three, I guess. You know, Vettel did get in one win there, but.
It's also surprising that Chevy has eight of the top 10 spots and they're not making a bigger deal out of this. And they've got the first five. I mean, that seems to me that you really could market yourself on that.
I mean, are we just missing it because we're not on the, you know, we're not on the right, reading the right Twitter feeds, or, you know, it doesn't
pop up on our Facebook feed? No, it's invisible to the public. This year's Indy so far is completely invisible.
Right, if we don't know about it, right. I mean, can you imagine just the normal person who is not looking at these things?
I mean, it's just true.
It's too bad. And this is the 99th Indianapolis 500.
No kidding,
yes.
99.
Yeah.
So, well, look, I'm going to be there. Like I said, I'm driving down to Indy starting out tomorrow morning. I'm looking forward to the whole thing. I think it's going to be awesome. But why it's so invisible is something that they really got to think about addressing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, hey, guys, we've reached the top of the hour here. Probably a good place to wrap it up. But Mike Austin, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks,
hope everybody reads all your stuff on Autoblog.
We got a whole team too. It's not just
I know. But and Gary, good seeing you.
So we'll look forward to the report next week on Indianapolis.
I'll report on Indy next week, and I'm trying to think. I just drove the MX-5 Miata. Also embargoed. I don't know is that I can talk about driving impressions next week. All I can say is it's a pretty damn good car. Probably the best Miata yet. So. We'll talk more about it when I can.
All right.
Anyway, good seeing all you guys.
Okay. Thank you.
I want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by the all-new 2015 Jeep Renegade.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline this week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.